Siren Song, a Ted Lasso musical. Written by Rockin' Hamburger and performed by KLB. Act 1, Chapter 1. Teddy Lasso is 10 years old when his father lowers the volume of the Kenny Rogers cassette playing over the car sound system and tells him he has a gift. "It's the same gift my father gave me, and his father before him," he says. "It's been passed down through generations of Lasso men." "A gift? Teddy loves gifts. What kind of gift, Dad?" "Well, now, hold your horses." His father smiles. "The one he wears when they're playing darts, and when Teddy's going a mile a minute," and his father brushes a soothing hand through his hair and murmurs, "Got a heaping load of energy and nowhere for it to go, huh, bud?" "This ain't just any old gift. This one's special." "A special gift?" Teddy squirms with excitement in his seat. "Yes. It's a gift you can use to help people," his father says. His smile slips. "But this gift can also be used as a weapon. Having this gift means you'll have power and influence over people. So I need you to promise you're going to use it carefully, that you won't use it to hurt anyone or make someone do things they don't want to." "Okay," Teddy says. He doesn't understand what his father is saying, not really, but he doesn't want to hurt anyone, and he wants to help people, to make his father happy and proud. "I promise." "All right," his father says. "Then I need you to repeat after me. A lasso can charm anybody into anything." Ted Lasso repeats. "A lasso can charm anybody into anything." As mornings go, this one is gearing up for a whopping 9.5. Ted's docking a half point for the milk hiccup, where some splashed over the side of his bowl. It has otherwise been a pleasant morning that he hopes is a bit of foreshadowing for the rest of the day. On second thought, maybe he's being harsh. After all, what about the bird song that gently roused Ted to consciousness a few minutes before his alarm, allowing him to turn it off before it could jolt him awake? 10 it is. He meets Miss Shipley in the stairwell as she's picking up the newspaper. "Morning, Miss Shipley." "Good morning," she replies. She gives him a smile. "And thank you for keeping the volume under control this weekend." Ted beams in delighted surprise. "Well, you're very welcome. I appreciate you, ma'am. You have a lovely day now." Ted can't help putting extra energy into his greeting as he nears Susan, who's setting up the chairs outside her coffee shop as usual. "Morning, Susan." "Ted," she says brightly. "It is always nice to see you." Ted pauses mid-step and turns toward her, gaping for a moment until he recovers with a broad smile. "Wow, that sure is nice of you to sing." She returns the smile and continues setting up the chairs. Ted watches her for a moment, still fairly stunned, before carrying on. This is shaping up to be an unforgettable morning. "Oi, wanker." "Hello there," Ted replies, wondering what mood the man is in today. It's a nice bit of unpredictability to his morning routine. "How are you, sir?" The man stops short, brows furrowing, and says, "You know, my doctor recommended these walks to help with my blood pressure." The man appears to hesitate. "You're a wanker, but you're not half bad." Ted blinks in bafflement after the man as he resumes his walk. Is there something extra nice in the water today? The joyful surprises don't end there. Everyone Ted passes has something to share with him, often in song. A teenager serenades him about their deep hatred for his puffer jacket. A different teenager shouts out his sneakers. The singing follows him to the clubhouse. Look, there he goes, that coach is strange but special. By the time Ted arrives at work, he is grinning from ear to ear and bouncing on his feet. Is it World Music Day? Actually, no, it isn't. That's June 21st. Maybe he's having a real vivid dream? Liam has a song to sing, too, when Ted enters the training center. Good morning, good morning. It's great to stay up late. Good morning to you. That was beautiful, Liam. Good morning to you. Rebecca isn't at her desk when Ted opens the door to her office. She's standing at the wide window, looking out onto the pitch. Ted's about to say, "Good morning, boss." But before he can speak, an instrumental piece starts playing. From where, Ted's not sure, and Rebecca starts to sing. Someone to hold you too close. Someone to hurt you too deep. Someone to sit in your chair and ruin your sleep. Ted lights up at the sound of her voice, beautiful as ever. Apparently, Rebecca's in a singing mood today, too. Or maybe she's just practicing for the next karaoke night. Ted finds himself grateful that Rebecca's sharing her voice with him today. As the thought occurs, she turns from the window and begins a slow, graceful walk to her desk as she sings, Someone to need you too much. Someone to know you too well. Someone to pull you up short. To put you through hell. Someone you have to let in. Someone whose feelings you spare. Someone who, like it or not, will want you to share a little, a lot. Someone to crowd you with love. Someone to force you to care. Someone to make you come through, who'll always be there, as frightened as you of being alive. Being alive. Being alive. Being alive. Ted's feet are planted on the floor. He is utterly transfixed by the emotion and longing in her voice, which feels like a mirror image of his own. Rebecca's face contorts as the music swells and she steps forward into a spotlight that appears out of thin air. Somebody hold me too close. Somebody hurt me too deep. Somebody sit in my chair and ruin my sleep and make me aware. Of being alive, being alive. Somebody need me too much. Somebody know me too well. Somebody pull me up short
and put me through hell, and give me support for being alive. Make me alive. Make me alive. Make me confused. Mock me with praise. Let me be used. Vary my days. But alone is alone. Not alive.
Ted startles as Rebecca spots him and clearly tries to stop, the music fading for a few moments. Her eyes widen, evident shock in her expression, as she continues to sing, as if forced to.
Somebody crowd me with love. Somebody force me to care. Somebody let me come through. I'll always be there. As frightened as you, to help us survive. Being alive. Being alive. Being alive.
Rebecca shudders as she finishes singing, and the instrumental music fades out. The breath is caught in Ted's throat. It feels as if Rebecca has sung the song that was in his heart, waiting desperately for someone to notice and deliver it. Tears sting his eyes, and he blinks furiously, clearing his throat. "Ted!" Rebecca gasps. Ted instantly feels like he wasn't supposed to be here. Rebecca is practically shrinking before his eyes. "Boss," he breathes out. "Gosh, that was..." But he cuts himself off as Rebecca stiffens and turns away. Her body language screams discomfort and mortification. "Oh," Ted says hoarsely. "I didn't mean to. I'll give you the room. Sorry." He is so frazzled in his desire to take away her pain that he forgets to leave the biscuits. Up until now, the singing has been fun and delightful. Suddenly, it seems alarming and strange, even invasive. Rebecca didn't seem to be able to stop herself. Something is very wrong. Unsettled, Ted makes his way straight to the office. Beard will have an idea of what the heck is going on. And sure enough, when Ted arrives, the familiar sight of Beard in his seat, legs propped on his desk and a book in his lap, is pretty damn comforting. "Coach," he says with relief. Beard looks up. As their eyes lock, an electronic beat starts as if someone just asked Alexa to play it. But as quickly as it started, the song cuts off as Beard jumps up, a book falling to his feet. He makes a beeline for the door, calling over his shoulder, "Be right back." The room is falling away from his senses. He can feel the panic starting to take over, so he does his 4-7-8 breathing. Doc Sharon's voice talking him through it. "It's going to be okay. It's going to be okay." It's not okay. It's clear now. Ted is the one making this happen. He's not sure how or why, but it's his presence that's causing all the chaos and discomfort. He can't be around anyone until he can figure out what the hell is going on and fix it. Roy is in the doorway when Ted turns around to leave. Oh, no, Roy! Ted backs up frantically as beats of musical accompaniment start. You can't be here, Ted says, smacking his hip into a desk in his urgency. You gotta... Roy's brow furrows in confusion, then outrage. The fuck is happening? Roy grits out, clutching his chest. Ted darts toward the other door, but doesn't reach it before Roy sings, You lift my heart up when the rest of me is down. Ted doesn't hear another note because he bolts. Roy is going to kill him. Ted keeps a steady jog the whole way home, weaving around people as their songs start and shouting apologies over his shoulder. It seems rude to make anyone sing, but isn't it rude to cut them off in the middle of their song? What is the etiquette for when you're apparently making everyone burst into song? Still, Ted reasons it's for the best. Back at his flat, Ted slumps in his kitchen chair, catching his breath and reeling from the emotional whiplash of his very strange morning. Is it that strange, though? Is it really a mystery? Ted gets to his feet to interrupt that train of thought. It doesn't make sense. This isn't something he's ever been able to do. This has nothing to do with that. Might as well put himself to work, so he starts to clean the kitchen. His thoughts mostly stay focused on the task at hand, but one does manage to shove its way through. A lasso can charm anybody into anything. Ted clinks the mug he's just rinsed off a drying plate as he's putting it in the dishpan. The sound pulls him back to his kitchen. It's not that. It can't be. His phone rings right as he's finishing up with the dishes. Beard. Ted hesitates. Whatever it is, exactly, that's causing people to sing, will it happen on the phone? Beard's probably factored that in. He's the sharpest tool in the whole shebang. You can hang up if you're feeling compelled to sing, Ted says when he answers. Although, saying that out loud, it sure is a ridiculous concept. Ridiculous or not, Beard says. Seems like that's what's happening. Ted releases a breath. If Beard is saying it, then Ted probably isn't losing his marbles. Got any hunches as to what on earth is happening? It ain't World Music Day, that I know. Beard snorts. Anything different happen this morning outside your normal routine? You mean apart from everyone serenading me? Nope, Ted says. Even the birds outside my window this morning sounded extra good. Now that I think about it, pretty sure they were doing a cover of Rockin' Robin. Bit on the nose, Beard says. What about last night? Anything out of the ordinary? Huh, Ted says. Guess the witch that appeared in my bedroom could have had something to do with it. Beard doesn't laugh, and Ted sighs regretfully. He's pushing his luck here. Nah, nothing that comes to mind. Sorry, Coach. What did the witch look like? Beard asks. You could settle an age-old question, Coach. Roald Dahl or Wizard of Oz? Ted beams, heart full. Man, if it'd been one of them Roald Dahl witches, you can be darn sure I wouldn't be joking around like this. Thank you, Roald Dahl, Beard deadpans, for your invaluable contribution to children's nightmares. Yeah, Ted says. He lets out a low whistle. Reading that one to Henry was a mistake. Anywho, can't think of any strange happenings. A lasso can charm anybody into anything. Ted swipes the thought away and forges on. You working through a theory with those sponge tendencies of yours? I do have a theory, but not one I'm ready to float without a bit more to go on, Beard says. Me and Roy will handle practice today. Thanks, Coach. Guilt unfurls in Ted's chest. I should stay out of the way. Don't want to make people do anything they don't want to. I need you to promise you'll use it carefully. That you won't use it to hurt anyone, or... I'll stop by after training, Beard says. Before Ted can protest, he adds, And if I burst into song, that's not on you. It's a risk I'm willing to take, okay? Ted swallows past the sudden lump in his throat. Okay. They hang up, and Ted returns to his cleaning, determinedly not thinking about any lasso family mottos. Chapter 2. Ted Lasso is 11 when his mother finds him hiding under the willow tree. There you are, she says, sitting down beside him with her sunshine smile. I was worried the wind swept you away. What are you doing all the way out here? Ted presses his forehead to his bent knees. I did something, he confesses, chest tight with fear and guilt. Something terrible. His mother's arm curls around his shoulders. You want to talk about it? I know that always helps when I'm feeling badly about something. Ted lets out a whoosh of breath, and with it, the words seem to come tumbling out. Sean and Tom and I were hanging out at the park, and then Ronnie Fouch came along, and I didn't want him there because he's always pranking everyone. So I thought really hard that he should leave, and then he did. But he didn't want to. Ted's breath hitches in his chest. I made him leave. His mother strokes his shoulder gently. Sweetie, you didn't make him leave. I did, he insists, distraught. Dad warned me that I gotta be careful, that I can influence people. That's what I did, isn't it? That isn't quite what he meant, baby, she says, kissing his forehead at the hairline. We can ask him later when he gets home, if you want to double check. But I've been married to your father for 12 years. He doesn't have the power to make me do things I don't want to. She points to the swaying branches of the tree that surround them. It's more like a breeze, gently pushing me in a direction. I can go that direction, and sometimes it's hard to tell if it's the direction I want to follow or the direction I'm being pulled in. But I can always walk against the wind. Ted watches the sway of the branches. He can hear the rustling leaves. So, I didn't make Ronnie Fouch leave? No, baby. You might have sent a breeze Ronnie's way, she says, but everyone has a choice. It's just hard, for anyone, to work out why they're making a choice. If it's what the person really wants, or if it's what others want. Ted basks in the warmth of her hand on his shoulder. So, that's why you gotta be careful. You gotta ask yourself if you're giving space for people to make choices. His mother kisses his cheek. And you, my sweet son, I know you're gonna make space. When Beard gets off the phone with Ted, he pulls up his Kindle copy of Spells and Enchantments in the 21st Century. His hunch is that Ted has been spelled, and that whoever did it had no idea Ted's already swimming in magic. For a guy with no magic to speak of, Beard's always been drawn to it like a magnet. People with magic just seem to find him, but it's not exactly a mystery why that is. When Beard was 6, his mother took his hand in hers, opened it up, and made a flower appear out of thin air. It would be a few years before he'd understand there was a difference between what his mother could do and illusion magic. His first girlfriend was a siren. So was his first boyfriend, his boss at Tower Records, and his college roommate, sophomore year, two of the people he roadied with for the Vicious Spikes in 96, the cruise ship dancer and the park ranger, and his weed dealer when he was living in Detroit. And Ted Lasso. So, Beard knows a few things about sirens. And making people sing? That's just not part of the deal. Beard knows the persuasive tug when a siren is in close proximity, the suggestive internal but foreign voice nudging towards a siren's preference, the intense desire to give up all worldly possessions and follow a siren for life. Singing, that's new. An outlier. He's never discussed the siren thing with Ted. He figures Ted has to know, unlike some of the sirens Beard's met, who had no clue and had less control of their capabilities. Even unaware sirens can't compel, but when they don't know what kind of power they have, it can be harder to resist. Ted is a special case. He uses his gentle powers of persuasion for harmonious good. Beard's been by Ted's side on a near-daily basis for more years than he cares to count. He is intimately aware that Ted is careful with his magic, that he restrains his abilities and barely makes an imprint. When he does let a suggestion through, it's always innocuous, like, "Would really appreciate if this Booster Club member could wander over to someone else for a while," or "I could do with a cheeseburger right about now." Easy enough to ignore, and harmless if someone does pick up on the suggestion. Sometimes, when Ted's exhausted or had a few, a bit more leaks through. Beard always knows when Ted hasn't been sleeping, because Ted will have a hard time controlling his desperate need to sleep. "God, someone let me sleep." That one, Beard's happy to oblige and enforce. Close Ted in the office for an hour, no matter how much he protests. And there was the night in college Ted was so drunk and horny he couldn't stop projecting his need for sex. Ted wasn't one to bring a stranger home, so he was suffering in silence. Beard had gritted his teeth through Ted's persuasion as well as his own desire to give Ted an orgasm so good he wouldn't need another for a while. On rare occasions, Ted is frustrated enough to reflexively use his powers. When one of the Wichita parents stormed into their office and raged at Ted about his coaching, Ted lost his saintly patience. Even then, Ted put up with it for a whopping 6 minutes before he projected, "Get the fuck out!" The guy had rapidly gotten the fuck out. Beard finds what he's looking for in the interaction section of the book, under music. Veritas, a powerful spell, compelling the bewitched to speak truth. It has been known to rebound and produce compulsion to sing one's truth when combined with old magic. For other side effects, see immunity, hair loss, migraines. That's one mystery solved. The question of who is responsible will need to wait until after he and Roy have held training. He meets Roy out on the pitch, and Roy's grunt of greeting is extra annoyed. Beard nods, but doesn't ask. Roy will talk about it if he wants to. Apparently he wants to. "There any particular reason I just tried to sing for Ted?" he asks through his teeth. clenched so tightly together, Beard spares a thought for Roy's jaw. Truth spell gone wrong, Beard answers. Pretty sure. In his peripherals, Beard watches Roy process that, live briefly in denial, then pass over into grumpy acceptance. Fuck. Yep, Beard says. I think someone's put a spell on Ted. Know anyone who might want to do that? Roy looks at him, and Beard knows they're on the same page. When Ted has run out of dirty surfaces and has nothing left to distract himself, he shoots Doc Sharon a message. He'll be catching her on her lunch break, so it shouldn't be too disruptive to her day. You free to talk today? No pressure. She calls within 2 minutes, while Ted's putting washed and dried empties in the recycling bin under the sink. Hi, Ted, she greets. Hey, Doc, he replies. Hope I'm not bothering you. Once again, you're not bothering me, she says, in the tone of a teacher who's repeated the instructions a few times already, but still has a few more in the tank. Let other people worry about whether I'm bothering them, Ted recites, smiling to himself. Yeah, I know. I'll get there someday. I know you will, she says warmly. What's going on? Well, Doc, you're not going to believe this, he says, picking up his pace between the counter and table. Today, everyone I meet has a song in their heart, and they feel compelled to share it with me. And not that I'm not grateful for the musical interludes, but I don't much like having an irresistible effect on people. And heck, I love the idea of someone bursting into song as much as the next person, but I'm hurting people just by being in their space, making them reveal emotional truths through song, and that's just plain wrong, ain't it? Ted, Sharon says, I know you're anxious right now, but I'm having trouble following. Right, right, Ted says, forcing himself to stop pacing. What do you mean, people are compelled to sing to you? Sharon asks. She sounds very tentative. Gosh, I guess I should back up here. Have you read The Odyssey? What am I saying? Of course you have, you being such a big reader and all. Are we doing the thing where you talk around the subject with pop culture references? She asks. He can hear the smile in her voice. Because while I have read The Odyssey, it was during uni, so my memory for the details is foggy. And I only have another 20 minutes until the end of my lunch break. I completely understand why you'd think I'm doing the thing, Ted says. But I'm afraid it's needed for context. You probably remember the whole bit with the sirens, harbingers of death with their irresistible voices. Here's the part you're not going to believe. That's not a fun story of fiction. Or it is. But it's based on a true story. In that I am one of those. Sharon is silent for a few moments. One of those sirens, Ted clarifies. Sharon is doing a great impression of his Nana's house after 7 o'clock p.m. He decides to wait her out. No point in pretending this isn't a huge reality pill to swallow. Eventually, she says, I'm sorry? Yeah, it's a patrilineal hereditary trait in the Lasso family, apparently. Ted sits at the table and fiddles with cloth draped across it. I have the power to influence people. Not sure about winning friends, though. Sharon lets out a long breath. You're serious. As open-heart surgery, Ted says. Don't know a lot of the details about the whys or hows. Kinda wish I'd thought to ask my dad more about it before. Well. Sharon hums with understanding. A sound Ted wishes he could bottle for when he's feeling especially low. I imagine it's very difficult to walk this path without him. Ted has to swallow around the emotion that swells in his throat. Yeah. After some honoring quiet, Sharon says, "The power of suggestion. I suppose that explains why I had the inexplicable urge to watch The Godfather with you during our last pub night." Ted chuckles. Oof, sorry about that. Guess I was thinking it'd be nice to watch one with a friend. Lots of sleepless nights last month, binging mafia movies. Good Lord, are there that many to watch? She asks in wonder. Never mind. All right. Sirens exist. You're one of them. This is very world-altering news. Ted smiles grimly. Don't I know it? I'm sorry, Ted. That sounds like a lot to carry, Sharon says, kind as ever. But the singing just started today? Yep, Ted says brightly, pleased about the shift in subject. Can't recall this particular side effect of my abilities, I guess we can call them. Ted, I'm sorry to derail, but I want to do so much research, Sharon says zealously. Where do I even start? Ted laughs. Beats me. Beard's my resident research assistant. So, something's happened to alter your effect on people, Sharon summarizes, to make them tell you the truth. Seems like it, Ted agrees. Is there anyone in your life who might want some truths revealed? Ted is so thunderstruck with awareness, he has to stand. Doc, you are a genius. Nate is looking at his phone as he exits the West Ham training facility. Beard's been waiting for Nate beside the shiny, brand-new Ferrari in the manager's parking space. Nate doesn't look up until he's about 5 feet away, and then he stops dead. His expression flickers with shock, nervousness, and guilt before he seems to school it to aloof. Coach, Beard greets with a nod. Nice ride. Can I help you with something? Nate asks, cutting to the chase. Works for him. Guess that depends, Beard says, arms crossed over his chest. Something weird's happening to Ted. You wouldn't happen to know anything about that, would you? Beard watches Nate's expression carefully, so he sees the caught look before it's banished. Don't know what you're talking about, Nate says stiffly. If you'll excuse me. He steps up to his car and unlocks it with a click of his key. The truth spell backfired, Beard tells him. Instead of Ted telling everyone his deep, dark secrets, it's got everyone telling theirs to Ted when they get too close. In song. Nate pauses in the act of opening his car door. And that might sound like a bit of harmless fun, but if Ted gets anywhere near the players, do you think the rest of the team might hear some things they shouldn't? Like confidential medical information or an accidental outing? Abruptly, Nate looks like he did when Beard asked him about the article. Beard's phone rings, and he pulls it out to a message from Ted. Might have a lead. Gotta go, he tells Nate. Good luck against Crystal Palace. Team's looking sharp out there. As he turns and walks away, Beard hears Nate get into his car. He doesn't hear the engine start during the whole walk back across the parking lot and out onto the main road. When he arrives at Ted's flat and Ted opens his door, they say in unison, "Nate!" Then, boom! Ted's face breaks into the smile that first hooked Beard hard and still hasn't let go. Ted goes to the kitchen to grab beers, blissfully unaware he's given Beard a moment to catch his breath from its radiance. In short order, Ted sinks into the sofa with a grunt beside Beard, and right as their fingers brush in the beer handover, Beard's song starts. Ted pulls his hand back quickly, and Beard closes his eyes tightly and concentrates. He cannot sing this to Ted. Fuck, if he sings this to Ted. Beard breathes out as the compulsion passes. Ted's watching Beard warily. Should I go in the next room? He asks with concern. Don't want to make you uncomfortable. No, it's past, Beard says, which is mostly true. The song is at the fringe, wavering in and out of his consciousness, but at least it's not pounding at the doorway, trying to break it open. Just say the word and I'll make a run for it, Ted says. He drinks what looks like a fortifying sip. Well, Coach, I gotta tell you something, and I know I should have told you a long time ago. Beard puts his beer bottle on his knee. You're a siren. Ted gapes at him. Beard, how on earth do you do that? Just know things. Beard shrugs, unable to stop his smile. How long have you known? Since the day we met, Beard answers. I seem to stumble on sirens. By the time I met you, I had a pretty good idea of what to look for. Ted shakes his head in wonder. You stumble on sirens, he repeats. Heck, why am I surprised? Course you do. Can't believe I could have been benefiting from your knowledge all this time. Ted fiddles with the label on the bottle. I should have told you. Sorry I didn't. Beard shrugs again. I don't think you owe the information to anyone. So you can nudge people and you draw people in. You can do a lot worse with no magic at all. Oof, I'll drink to that, truth bomb. Ted clinks the necks of their bottles together and takes a symbolic drink. So, do you think Nate worked it out? That I'm... No, Beard says. I don't think this was part of his plan. I think he dabbled in some magic and got unlucky. Ted rubs his face. Man, did I ever drop the ball with him. We dropped the ball, Beard reminds him. Should have told you about his run-in with Colin. And all I told him was to do better. Never explained how. That might not have happened at all if I'd been paying attention, Ted counters. I was too distracted. I built him up, and then I made him feel invisible. I mean, I laughed at him. Yeah, you made mistakes, Beard agrees. We both did. Are you going to make those same mistakes again? Not a chance. And you're going to do what you can to make it right? Of course. Beard nods. We'll do it differently next time. Better. You know where you misstepped. Yeah. But it doesn't change the fact that I hurt Nate. I failed him. So reach out to him. Do I need to get the scissors? Beard points out. Ted makes a wistful face, clearly remembering Nate's follow-up. To cut yourself some slack. You had a lot going on. Ted tuts. That's no excuse. No. But it's a reason. Oh. A reason, Ted says. And he's getting tetchy. Well, that's fine, right? Miss something important? No big deal. There was a reason. Beard could back down. But maybe that's the problem, that he backs down when Ted might need something different. Okay. But I also missed what was going on with Nate, he says. And I had reasons. I was pretty distracted with Jane last year. So, I failed him too. It's not the same, Ted says impatiently. Me missing that? How much Nate was hurting? If I just done more. Beard gets the distinct feeling Ted isn't just talking about Nate anymore. Here's a thought exercise, Beard says. Say we don't drop the ball. Say we help Nate adjust to the new level of responsibility and supervise him better. Call him in when he's coming down on Will. Speak up instead of thinking he just needs a grace period. Say we check in with him more. Make a better effort to value his contributions and validate him. Say we do all that. Maybe it's the difference maker. But what if it isn't? Ted gets to his feet in a sudden burst of energy. So Beard stands too, putting the sofa between them to give Ted physical space if he needs it. I don't accept that, Ted thunders. I'm not sure you can afford not to, Beard says, going for broke, or else you will collapse under the weight of everyone's problems. You can't stop every bad thing from happening. You think I don't know that? Ted demands. Couldn't fix my marriage, couldn't help Nate, couldn't... Ted cuts himself off, swearing under his breath. There it is. Couldn't what? Beard asks. He has to step carefully here. Back off if Ted's not ready. But Ted looks at Beard with devastating despair, his voice like sandpaper. Couldn't save my dad. And then he crumples. Beard makes it in time to support his weight. The mangled cry of despair bursts out of Ted, and he's 16 and his father is gone. He can't breathe. His throat is raw from crying and screaming at the top of his lungs. He's going to wake up any second. This is a horrible nightmare. And Beard's holding him. The clean, warm smell of Beard grounds Ted in the moment. He's still making a lot of noise into Beard's shoulder. But at least he's not back there. Back in the basement. Thank you, Ted gasps. Beard just holds him tighter. When Ted's steadier, Beard leads him to the couch and returns from the kitchen with a glass of water. Ted didn't know how thirsty he was until Beard pressed it into his hand. Always know just what I need, Ted says, touched but also inexplicably terrified. The words are there, and they seem to have come from a deep well inside him. I'll be in real trouble if you ever decide you've had your fill of coaching. When he manages to look up, Beard's giving him an inscrutable look. Then he says, "Not gonna happen. Coaching's my life." Ted only feels a bit reassured. After all, it's not really coaching he's worried about Beard getting sick of. Chapter 3. Fucking mind games. Nate turns on the radio and starts the drive home, trying to focus on the TalkSport analysis of the upcoming Brentford versus Everton match. It works for about a minute. Of course Ted sent Beard for him. Figures. So, it's true. Magic does exist. He hadn't actually expected it to work. When Nate found the book of spells on a bench in the locker room with a note attached, "To help with your hopeless chip shot," he assumed it was a joke gift between players, possibly Anthony and Carlos. They're always fucking with each other. Nate had tried out a smoothing spell on his wrinkled shirt, but when he inspected it under the studio lights in the kitchen, his flat didn't get a lot of natural light, he could find no observable difference. Nate had chalked it up as nonsense and tossed the book in his bag to return to the locker room in the morning. A few hours later, Nate happened to catch the post-game Richmond interview on telly. Richmond had lost the match, and their head coach had been asked if he was worried going into the match against Newcastle. "No more than my general state of worry, which I'm managing with a course of mental health treatment that spares me the worst of anticipating the worst." And then he'd winked. Why couldn't Ted just tell the damn truth? And couldn't anyone else see through the mask? Always papering things over with a folksy nothing-to-see-here facade. Blindly optimistic, unable to see what was right in front of him. Nate had angrily fished the book out of his bag, where he found a truth spell that he tossed impulsively at the image of Ted on his screen. It obviously wasn't going to work, but in the extremely unlikely chance it did, maybe the next press conference would be a little more honest. Maybe Ted would finally admit he had no idea what he was doing, that he was lost without... Nate parks his car and enters his flat. The late day sun means he has to turn the light on in the entry hall to avoid a knocked shin. He moved in last month, and he's still tripping over the console table by the door like a clumsy goddamn idiot. He has his interview with 442 next week, which he should prepare for so he doesn't have any Wonder Kid repeats. Just the thought of it makes him queasy, so he pours himself a ginger ale and turns on Sky News. He'll prepare in a bit. He holds out for 2 minutes before he sets his glass down to retrieve his bag from where he set it down by the door. He curses when he bumps the console table on his way back to the sofa, then takes out the book of spells. It's too dark in the room to read, so he turns the lamp on. It couldn't have worked. But if it did, somehow, then why is everyone singing to Ted? That's not what he cast, is it? Sure enough, when he checks, Veritas makes no mention of forcing the people around the Enchanted to sing their hearts out. God, it's probably not even true. A weird coincidence, maybe? No, that's mad. It's too bang on to be a coincidence. How could Ted or Beard know he tried a spell from a random lost and found book? If the spell is making people confess their secrets to Ted, maybe there's a way to reverse it. It's not that he cares about Richmond anymore. He absolutely does not. But if it's making people reveal their truths to Ted instead of the other way around, well, that's just not what he wanted. Nate turns to reversals. When he sees what's required, his stomach starts churning all over again, and he closes the book and sets it aside. He has an interview to prepare for. Why should he care about deep, dark secrets being revealed when no one there ever cared about him? Even bloody magic he can't do right. His phone chimes, and when he sees the message, nausea sets in. "Hi, Nate. It's Ted." It reads, "I was hoping we could talk. Got an apology I need to give. And if you don't want an apology from me, now or ever, no hard feelings. Or if you decide you want one down the road, you can let me know. Your call. You don't owe me anything. Best of luck with the match on Saturday." Nate puts his phone down on the arm of the sofa, heart racing. He can't do it. He can't. Not after everything. He won't do it. Ted's just messaging him so everything can return to normal. Ted's not genuinely going to apologize. Nate did too much to expect that. Anyway, he can't go back. And he doesn't want to. He matters now. He gets to call the shots at West Ham. Most of the time. Mr. Mannion has the final say, of course, but that's to be expected. It is his club, after all. Yes, it can be admittedly frustrating when Nate spent all day coming up with a plan of attack and Mr. Mannion vetoes it, but that's power, isn't it? Making those calls. Nate likes being the boss. He gets to decide who's starting and which tactics they'll use. It's his locker room, which means he's in charge of how it operates. He can change the culture and stop harassment in its tracks, make sure the players are focusing on the game they're paid a great deal of money to play, instead of bullying the weak links in the social food chain. Changing the culture hasn't been easy, though. Some players are receptive to feedback, and others are decidedly not. Last week, when Nate told Daniel to cut out the casually homophobic comments, Daniel whipped his water bottle across the locker room and stormed out. Nate made him run laps, of course, but he's still working out how to get back the rapport they were developing before that. Still, it had to be done. There's at least one closeted player on the team, and God knows who else besides. Nate noticed Jonathan's partner always picks him up about 10 minutes after everyone else has left. He couldn't let Daniel's comments slide. The job is difficult. There's a lot that goes into managing a team, and there's the press and the fan base, both of whom never seem to be impressed for very long. They're always looking ahead to the next win or the next fuck-up, ready to pounce and criticize, as if they have any idea what it's like to run a team of people to athletic success. The other day, someone shouted a few choice slurs at him through a car window. Nate tried not to let it get to him, but he couldn't stop shaking until he was home. Sometimes, it feels like there's no way to win, that he's in a Kobayashi Maru. He can't help feel like the interview next week is a trap, and that he can prepare all he wants, but they'll find a way to make him sound stupid or naive or arrogant or angry. And on one awful occasion, when they caught him reacting to a bad ref call, violent. No matter what he says, his words get twisted. It's terribly lonely sometimes. He gets along with his assistant coaches, but it's very professional. There are no meetings where the coaching staff talk about personal problems. But that's good, isn't it? Since that was a waste of time when they could have been working on strategies. Still, it was nice, sometimes, to be part of a team, to feel included, and to have a valve from all the pressure. But there's no taking back what's happened. There's no getting back what he doesn't want Ted's apology. He doesn't want to forgive Ted, not when he can still feel the sting of abandonment and rejection under his skin. There's nothing Ted can say that would change how he feels. Besides, would Nate start singing? Oh God, what would he sing? It doesn't matter. Nate has said his piece. What else does he have left to share with Ted that he hasn't already said? He spilled all the ugly feelings he had in him the last time he set foot on Richmond soil. He said the truth, and Ted asked him for it. But maybe he hadn't meant to reveal quite so much. Maybe he wishes he hadn't said the bit about Ted getting shipped back to Kansas with his son, where he belongs. The gnawing feeling in his stomach is too much like guilt for his liking. He suspects the ginger ale will do nothing for it. Because Nate seems to be cursed, Jeff Stelling interrupts Nate's thoughts from the Sky Sports panel. Coach Lasso wasn't available for a post-training interview this morning, citing a mental health day. What do you think about that, George? It's like I said, Katrick oozes. Can't run a tight ship if you're a loose cannon. I see, Jeff says. And what do you say, Chris? I'd like to see the idea normalized, Jeff, Chris replies. I took one last week after our dear old dog crossed the Rainbow Bridge. Did Ted really take a mental health day? Or is that another lie? Is his spell causing Ted anxiety? Nate's not worried or anything, but when he cast the spell, this wasn't what Nate wanted. God, he's not sure what he wanted, but not this. Nate picks up his phone. He never did delete Ted's number. He'd emptied their message chain, but he couldn't quite sever that connecting line. He presses the call button with a trembling finger, then curls it into a fist and stands. It doesn't even ring once before Ted answers. He sounds breathless. Hey, Nate, I'm so glad you called. Heart traitorously racing, Nate crosses to the kitchen island. Anger is already building, so he takes a rallying breath. You said you have an apology, he says, trying to keep his voice neutral. He's not sure he manages it. Yes, I do. Ted sounds like he did in Liverpool. Nate, I'm sorry. I was supposed to be there for you and support you in your rise. Then I wasn't. I let you down. And I didn't even notice until you had to get my attention. You deserved so much better than what I gave you. And I completely understand why you're angry. Nate lays his palm on the marble. He needs something solid to hold on to. His knees are shaking. Ted doesn't mean it. He's full of shit. He talks a big game, but he doesn't care about Nate. Not really. He's assuaging his own ego or his guilt, or trying to clean up his image now that Nate knows what he's really like. His breath hitches. What makes you think you understand anything about what I feel? You're right. Ted's voice is quiet. I can't know, not for sure. But you're right to be angry. You needed me to be a better boss and supervisor, a better friend. I made you feel unimportant and undervalued. I laughed at you. I didn't take the time to check in and make sure you were okay. I missed what you were going through, but especially how much you were hurting. Nate closes his eyes, desperately holding on to the simmering anger. He should never have called. Ted's twisting it all up, trying to make him feel guilty. It won't work. Ted should have left him cleaning fucking towels for the rest of his measly life. At least then he wouldn't have gotten all twisted up by Ted and his belief. Wouldn't have dared to hope for anything different than neglect and disregard. Nate, there's nothing I can say or do to erase all that, Ted says, voice pained. I know that some wounds cut deep and don't ever heal. Not completely. I wish I could go back and do right by you. You deserved better. Nate hangs up. He doesn't want to hear this. He wants something else. Something that's burrowing into his chest and making a home there. He doesn't want Ted's useless apology. He wants to push Ted to something else. But what? It's right there, unfurling like a snake. Nate walks over to pick his keys up off the console table, kicking it aside as he leaves. What is it going to take? He exposed Ted's panic attacks, ran out on the team, and tore Ted's fucking sign down on the way out. He told Ted to go back to his son. All that, and he deserves a bloody apology? Fuck that. He wants Ted's anger. The engine starts with a roar, and Nate takes a deep breath and runs his hands along the steering wheel. Wouldn't do any good to crash this thing. He can just imagine the headline now. West Ham Shelley endangers telephone pole. He puts the anger on a leash and drives. He's the one in control, in the driver's seat. When Nate arrives, he parks and marches to Ted's front door. He knocks and waits, letting his anger off the leash right in time for the door to open on Beard. Nate deflates. Is he not even here? He demands. Beard eyes him. No, he's here. But you might not want to. Nate brushes past him and takes the stairs quickly. And when he reaches the landing, Ted's sitting on the sofa, but he hurries to his feet. Just the sight of him makes Nate's heart pound and his blood race. All right, you listen to me. Then it happens. From somewhere beyond the coiled anger, music is coming. And then it's outside of him. Nate stills and shouts, No! Nate, hang on, Ted starts backing up rapidly, but there's a wall behind him that he collides with. Nate scrambles backward too, but there's nowhere to go. He has no idea what's about to come out of him. It's utterly terrifying. Thank you. Beard rushes into the room and puts himself between Nate and Ted. "Nate, the kitchen," he says. And then his own song starts, the electronic beat filling the room and interrupting Nate's song instantly. He doesn't know for sure what was about to come out of Nate, but he knows what it's like to be around Ted's siren magic. Just because Beard can resist, that doesn't mean Nate can. Nate bolts through the archway as Beard lets the song flow out, dancing off the compulsion to sing. Now is not the time or place, but he can take this one for the team. But now that he's unleashed the music, it takes some time to put it back. He dances until he can't feel the song pounding at the door to be let out, to be sung, until eventually it's quiet again. Ted nods at Beard and thanks, and Beard gives him one in return. He hitches his thumb over his shoulder, indicating he's going to give Ted and Nate some time to talk on their own. Ted nods again, and that's his cue for an exit. When Beard has left, Ted takes a few steadying breaths and parks himself on the other side of the kitchen wall. "Nate," he calls, "are you okay with me being here, or do you want me to leave?" "It's your bloody flat," Nate calls from the other side of the kitchen wall. "And I came here, didn't I?"
"You did," Ted agrees.
"Want me gone? Can't stand the thought of me being here. Is that it?" "I just don't want to make you uncomfortable," Ted says, tamping down on the impatience starting to make itself known.
"Oh, sure," Nate says, sardonic. "You don't want to make me uncomfortable."
"It's the last thing I want," Ted tells him. Nate scoffs. "So concerned about my comfort, when you know I fucking cast the spell on you." The confirmation it was Nate doesn't sting. Ted thinks he understands why Nate did it. He wanted to know why Ted abandoned him. Ted gets that yearning, but he's also pretty sure, from personal experience, that there's no good answer to the question.
"I get it," Ted says.
"Don't pretend you understand me," Nate snaps. "And don't pretend you care when it's obvious you don't."
That stings.
"I'm sorry I've made you doubt that I care."
"Another apology!" Nate sounds incensed.
"I don't want one of those. I want you to be honest with me. Tell me how you actually feel." A strong flare of irritation comes to life in Ted's hands. He puts them in his pockets and blows out a calming breath.
"This isn't about me," Ted says tightly. "I start telling you how I feel about the whole thing, and that puts me front and center. The focus should be on you and how I let you down."
"Why?" Nate demands.
"Because you're Ted Lasso, and you always do the right thing?"
"Obviously that ain't true," Ted says curtly, breathing through ripples of anger.
"You know that better than most."
"Then why are you being so goddamn noble? For once, just say what you really mean. Don't hide behind should."
Ted abandons his pockets and runs shaking hands through his hair.
"And how's that gonna help? Is it gonna change anything about what happened between us? If I tell you I'm boiling mad at you for telling what really happened at the Spurs match, that it cut deep, is that gonna make you feel better?"
Nate storms into the room.
"Yes, because at least then I know..."
Music cuts Nate off. Rooted to the spot, Ted helplessly watches as Nate is forced to sing. I've been watching your world from afar. I've been trying to be where you are. And I've been secretly falling apart, unseen. To me, you're strange and you're beautiful. You'd be so perfect with me, but you just can't see. You turn every head, but you don't see me. I'll put a spell on you. You fall asleep when I put a spell on you. And when I wake you, I'll be the first thing you see. And you'll realize that you love me.
Nate's face is riddled with pain and fear. Just like with Rebecca this morning, Ted can feel his own reflected in Nate's song. Nate sings through the shine of tears in his eyes, and Ted can't make himself look away. He's got to hear this one out. Clearly, he owes Nate that much.
Sometimes the last thing you want comes in first. Sometimes the first thing you want never comes. But I know that waiting is all you can do. Sometimes I'll put a spell on you. You fall asleep when I put a spell on you. And when I wake you, I'll be the first thing you see. And you'll realize that you love me.
Nate covers his face, shoulders heaving. Ted doesn't know what to do but to try and provide comfort, to show Nate that he does love him, that Ted only wants the best for him. He steps forward. Nate. But Nate backs away. And then he runs. The slam of his front door tells him Nate's gone. Ted walks to his room, gets into bed, and pulls the covers up. Tomorrow. He'll work on reversing this tomorrow. But right now, he's so damn tired of hurting the people he cares about. He has had about as much of that as he can take. End of Act One. House lights come up. Everyone starts mumbling to each other. Hurry up before the bathroom line gets too long. Grab some snacks. See you back here in 15.